This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You're listening to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho-Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanhounds.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I gotta be careful about that space between the hard and traveling. I'm Greg Phillips. With me here in luxurious Ho-Ho-Loon Plaza, the L-shaped studio. You can hear the police sirens in the background. A very crime-ridden day here in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
That's because we're here today. We're coming here today to talk about a book that is a crime against humanity. But we'll get into that in a minute.
Yes, indeedy doddly do. And you know, we are here. I don't even know how else to put this. This is an episode of the Long Book Hunters, which is where we take a look at a trade paperback collection or graphic novel. And as you all may recall, several months ago, maybe even a year ago.
Yes, it was in January of last year.
Nick Duke, my compadre here, forced me to read what may be my least favorite Batman story of all time, the A.J. Lieberman atrocity known as Hush Returns. So, since a year has passed, I felt it appropriate to pay back my colleague, my brother in arms, by forcing him to read what may be his least favorite Batman story of all time. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we are here today to discuss Batman R.I.P. This, a story from 2008. Drawn by Tony Daniel and written by the illustrious, the brilliant Grant Morrison. And, you know, before we get into that, folks, we are recording later in the week than usual. We're recording on a Thursday. And I just want to say, in the past on this show, my companion, my brother in arms, as I mentioned earlier, Nick Duke, has often cast disparaging remarks my way, sarcastic remarks my way about delays to the show. Well, the last few times that we've been delayed, seems to always be Nick Duke that's causing the delays.
No. It seems to be circumstances outside of my control.
Oh, what were the circumstances on Tuesday night, Nick?
No, why do you got to focus on Tuesday, Greg? Why can't you focus on Wednesday?
Because you had a legitimate reason on Wednesday night, I wouldn't put you under the fire for that.
Put me under the fire, or aren't you just a noble soul? Aren't you just a bleeding heart? Aren't you just filled with compassion?
I am. They used to call me compassionate Greg.
Our readers don't care. Our listeners, our readers of our audio podcast don't care about listening to this. Let's move on.
Oh, they could be. Some of our listeners may be the same people that read our columns back in the day. The same six people.
It's probably the same seven people. Yeah, that's a good point. So Tuesday I came home and I fell asleep on the couch. And when I woke up, I was so discombobulated and exhausted and just went back to sleep. So I didn't do the podcast. There you go. Is that what you wanted to hear, Greg? Are you happy now? Does that make you feel like a big man now? Do you feel all proud of yourself now?
It makes me feel like I'm packing grapefruits right now instead of little plums. Makes me feel
huge balls, tiny dick. That's the tradition here in Ho-Ho-Loon Studios.
Yes, that's right. You want balls so large that when you sit down, you squish them.
If we're gonna
appear so small that you can't see them in the microscope.
If it were just a genitals weighing contest, we'd come out quite favorably, I think.
What are we talking about? Why are we talking about this at the beginning of this show?
I don't know.
This is ridiculous.
I don't know.
Ridiculous. Anyway, This is stupid. Why are we talking about all this?
This whole episode is going to be stupid.
Or is it to distract us from what we have to talk about here?
I don't know. This is the worst thing. It's just.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Are you ready to talk about John Mayhew and Mangrove Pierce and Simon Hurt and Le Bossy?
You mean Monsieur Le Bossy? El Sombrero.
And
the Lump.
Pierrot Lunaire.
God.
Knight and Squire.
No.
The others?
No. No, I'm not. Quite frankly, I'm not.
Oh, I'm not.
What about the bat radia?
Oh, what about the bat labia?
Sadly, that did not make an appearance in this story. That would have been a much more interesting story had it done so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here we are already.
Here we are already at this point. As I'm trying to, what is that group called? Are they the group that helps them out at the end? Are they the Club of Heroes?
Yes, the Club of Heroes.
And they are opposed by the Club of Villains?
Yes. That's what we have. Very inventive names here for Mr. Morrison. You could tell he really put his all into
El Sombrero might be my favorite.
El Sombrero.
And you know, El Sombrero is not even wearing a sombrero in some of his early scenes in this.
No, he's like a luchador. He's wearing a lucha mask.
He should be called La Luchadora, maybe.
That would be better.
Or El Luchador. I don't know. El Hijo del Luchador, maybe.
He could just be called Luchador. Just drop it to one name. That's the trend these days.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Or I guess if he was El Sombrero, he could just be El.
El. There we go. I like that.
Very good. Very good. In any event, we have to get started on this somehow. So,
I suppose.
In 2000 and what was it, Nick? 2006 that Grant Morrison took over?
He was writing when I started reading Batman. So, like, I've told this story here on the podcast. I didn't start buying monthly comics until 2006, yeah. The summer before I went to college, I finally discovered there was a comic shop in Enterprise, Alabama. Drove over there and put all the Ultimate Marvel books as well as Batman and Detective Comics on my first ever pull list. And when I started reading in May of that year, Grant Morrison was writing Batman, and we were off and running from there. I had not come in time for Batman and Son. I had just missed that, but I believe I would have come in right around the time of the resurrection of Ra's al Ghul, which was a story that bounced back and forth between Batman and Detective Comics, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, so around that general time, Grant Morrison took over essentially the control of the Batman character, right? He's writing the main Batman book. He's not writing Detective Comics, but he is kind of guiding the path of DC's most popular character.
Sure.
Morrison, we've talked about various times on this show, has a long and storied history in comics. He's considered an A-list creator, known for All-Star Superman is probably his most famous work.
But, Arkham Asylum would be up there, I think, as
Arkham
well.
Asylum, A Serious House on Serious Earth, which was done back in the early 90s, his first work with Batman.
Isn't that technically late 80s, if I recall correctly?
I thought it was 1990, maybe 89.
I don't know.
It's right around there. And he's done, of course, big runs on the X-Men, New X-Men in particular. JLA is another book that he might be most well-known for, you could make an argument for. He's done pretty much every character under the sun, just about, he's written. He's currently writing Green Lantern. And
yes,
he is
because ruining my absolute favorite character in comics wasn't enough. Now he has to come out after one of my second favorite character.
So, Morrison is known for...
October of 89, by the way.
Morrison is known for his, shall we say, eccentricities. He is known for writing very trippy, out there, some say complex, some say convoluted comics. And it all depends on your outlook on it. Some of these books have been received very well. Some of these books have been very divisive. As is the case, Nick, I understand, with a book that you are reading for another podcast right now. But the one thing that's been consistent about Grant Morrison is he has always had a very devoted fan base.
Oh, God.
That believe him to be
infallible.
The equal or superior to one of his great enemies, Alan Moore. They don't like each other at all, and they've been battling through their words since the 80s, basically. And they are not compatible with one another, which is interesting because they seem to share a lot of overlap with fans and tend to try to do, I think, similar things with the way that they craft their stories. Although, yes, I would argue that Alan Moore crafts his stories in a much better way.
One is the shitty Diet Coke version of the other, I suppose.
There you go. So Morrison had been writing Batman for a couple of years by this point. He had about roughly 2 years of build up to this story. He had done some of the stories that came before this, Batman and Son, which introduced Damian Wayne to the world. He did some sort of prose Joker story.
That was actually good. I'll throw that out there. That was a good issue of Batman.
And he follows that. He precedes RIP, I believe this directly preceded it anyway, with a story called The Black Glove, which introduced a concept called The Black Glove.
Which is different than the Club of Villains, apparently.
Yes, the Black Glove is different from the Club of Villains.
Even though it's the same fucking thing.
And,
Shares members in common.
Yep. Yeah, I wasn't really sure what exactly the Black Glove was by the end of this book, but we'll get...
The Black Glove is five villains. It's five... It can only be five. So I think that by the end, the implication is that it is Dr. Simon Hurt, Jezebel Jett, and some other people. About spoilers.
There's the general that the Joker breaks his neck. There's this other guy, the Reverend, maybe. And then there's another guy that's there that I don't know the name of, and I'm not sure if it's ever established. And then there's, the Club of Villains, which includes Le Bossu and many of the others that we've mentioned. Anyway, the Black Glove story, supposedly, which we didn't read for this podcast, I should make that very clear. The Black Glove story supposedly introduces the concepts that set up this, which we should mention, by the way, that we are reviewing Batman RIP the Deluxe Edition. This is a version that can be found on Hoopla, the app Hoopla. It can be found through Amazon, through your local comic shop, probably. If you find Batman RIP at a store these days, a bookstore, this is probably the version you're going to find. As far as I know, this is the definitive version of this story. So, with that said, you better damn well have read The Black Glove before you read Batman RIP. And you know what? You probably better have read that Joker story. And you probably better have read Batman and Son. And you probably better have read every Batman story from the 1950s and 60s. And 70s and 80s. And probably 90s before you even start on this book. We did not.
I can hear it now, Greg. I can hear all those Richards on the internet saying, oh, Greg and Nick don't like stories that reference other stories. They don't like deep continuity. I can hear the Tim Caples and the Todd Webbers and the Ben Morses of the world criticizing us for not wanting to have to dig through decades of continuity to understand eight fucking issues. So be it. What of it?
And you know where they can send all their concerns, Nick?
To @JRsBBQ.
That's right. That's right. So, you better go into this book very steeped in this continuity. And by continuity, I don't mean actual continuity. I don't mean the contemporary, as of 2005, Batman continuity. No, I mean you need to be steeped in every Batman story that has ever been written. Because one of Grant Morrison's stated purposes and claims behind his Batman run is that he wanted to encompass and incorporate everything. Every era of Batman. Fair enough.
Not just every era.
Story of Batman. Everything that has happened. Every reboot that DC has done. All of it. Everything counts was his philosophy. So, starting with...
Which is literally impossible given the very definition of a reboot, which reboots continuity and chooses selectively to discard certain elements. You can't have both the reboots and the prior continuity. It doesn't work.
Everything going back to Detective 27 is fair game. That includes all those crazy stories from the 50s where Batman and a version of Batwoman that does not officially exist in continuity took off to space and fought Martians. All the stuff in the 60s with the exploding pies and the timid Joker and the jokes, the just general lighthearted 60s TV show tone to the comics, all of that. Everything up through the 80s with the Killing Joke and all that, through the 90s with Cataclysm and Nightfall and all that stuff. Everything counts. All of it is together and ties into the Batman's history. And right from the start, Nick, as soon as we opened the first page of this book, I was lost. I was utterly and completely lost opening this first, because we start out with this Hannibal Lecter and Clarice Starling
Greg, that speaks to why this review of this book is really irrelevant coming from us, because, as you said, you were lost. The reason that we don't like this book, Greg, is because we're just not smart enough to get it. That's the problem.
That's true. That really boils this podcast. We can end it right now, honestly. Yep. We don't need to have a second half. We're just not smart enough to get this story.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had any doubts about that, the fans of this story will tell us.
Yes.
We're just not intelligent enough to understand what's happening.
Yes. If you don't like any Grant Morrison story written post-2000, it's because you're just not smart enough to get it.
Yep. And we're going to come back to that, Nick. We're going to circle back around to that concept once we're done talking about this story. So keep that in mind, audience. That's a little nugget that will pay off later on. Well, I was just really confused because we get this Hannibal Lecter and Clarice Starling intro with the Joker who's locked up in Arkham and Batman talking to the Joker and trying to uncover information about the Black Glove. Who is the Black Glove? But the Joker's just playing games with him. He's laying out cards. He's laying out, Nick, the dead man's hand.
Yeah.
I don't know why this is important, but you know it's important because they use the term dead man's hand approximately 645 times over the course of this 200-page book.
And it's important because when he asked the Joker, what is the Black Glove, he deals an 8 and an ace and an 8 and an ace. And, of course, the eighth letter of the alphabet is H, spelling out ha, ha.
Ha. My God. It's genius.
It really
it's
is.
It's already genius. I get it now, Nick. I get that part now. Wow.
The Joker made a laugh pun.
When you lay out the ace as an ace, brother.
No, hey now.
You know what that means?
Hey now. No flag, brother. No flag.
You know, you might have a little bit of you might have a little bit of Bully Ray in there. You might have a little bit of Brother Devon, Mr. Anderson, Taz.
True.
Might even have just a little bit, brother. Hulkamania going on there.
Well, you know.
Or Brookamania, anyway.
Hulkamania, you know, has left an indelible mark on the world. It's important to mention here because we have just seen the anniversary of Hulk Hogan winning the WWF title from the Iron Sheik there. And it's important to mention that some places that Hulkamania goes, he leaves an indelible mark on, such as, might I suggest, the Silver Dome, brother, which was a wonderful place to be, a wonderful place to see this past weekend. So, and that's all I'll say about that.
Lord. You're rolling high and mighty.
Oh, it was.
But let's bring it back to something that'll make you even higher and more mighty. Let's bring it back to Zur-En-Arrh.
You have to be high to enjoy this piece of shit. I mean, that's pretty much that's who it's written for. Let's dispense with the pleasantries. It is written. Grant Morrison wrote this story for himself, which is fine. You know, a lot of writers, you know, come from the standpoint of what would I like to see? What kind of take on the character would I like to see? And Grant Morrison's take is something that can only be comprehended or potentially comprehended by the mind of a drug-addled maniac. That's what he wants to see. He wants to see a vision of Batman that is filtered through the lens of psychedelics and nonsense. And that's what we get here. Psychedelics and nonsense.
Psychedelics and nonsense. Good name for an album.
And pretentious pseudo-psychobabble. It was just...
Oh, there's a lot of that. Oh, there's. I'm glad you said that, Nick, because that's a great segue. If you love pretentious pseudo-psychobabble, you'll love this book.
Yep.
Because it's filled with it, starting from the opening pages. Because the Joker and Batman have a conversation that is nothing but psychobabble.
Right. And it's like a, it's what is it, like a three-page scene? And then right after that scene ends, there's a giant splash page, and Morrison is telling you, he is telling you how pretentious he's going to be with this fucking book, because the splash page in giant letters says, "This will be a work of art." Horseshit is what it is.
This is such an ineffective cold opening to a comic. There's no introductory page to this collection to tell us here's what you've missed to this point. And in fairness to DC Comics, they probably would have had to add an extra 30 pages to this of text just explaining what the hell has happened, as if he's just terrified to his bones the next moment. There's no context for any of this, you see. None. And this is a story called Batman RIP, which you have to know as a writer. You have to know as a company. A bunch of people are going to buy this story because you are teasing the death of Batman. Now, wait a minute, Nick. I know that is a little out there to tease an event and call an event something that revolves Batman and then deliberately not deliver on the event that a bunch of people are buying the story to read.
He delivered upon it, Greg. It was because the idea of Batman, Bruce's idea of Batman, died and then was resurrected, you see.
In any event, we're also introduced in short order in this book to what I thought was the Black Glove, but was in fact part of the Black Glove in addition to the Club of Villains. Your doorstep, I trust for someone of your talents, this will not be a problem. And Dr. Hurt, of course, informs him that no, the Black Glove is already taken care of it. His dental records are already being erased, even though the man was literally just killed. A stranger was just killed, and his dental records are already being erased at the federal level. Nick, how'd that work?
I don't know.
Fair enough. We're introduced to these characters, and of course their ringleader is the aforementioned Dr. Simon Hurt. Now, Dr. Simon Hurt, here's an interesting bit of what Morrison likes to do that pisses me off. We've talked a lot. And this is not going to turn into a Jeff Johns blowjob podcast like we've done in the past. Far be it from that. He's just the first author that comes to mind when I think of this. We have talked in the past about how much we love Jeff Johns and his ability to take obscure C and D list characters and reform them into A list and B list characters, right?
Yes.
Well, Grant Morrison likes to take super obscure characters and just pop them back in as if they've been there the whole time.
Can we confirm that these characters actually existed?
Some of them did, some of them didn't. Dr. Hurt, according to Wikipedia, is based on an unnamed scientist who first appeared in Batman number 156, June 1963, in a story, which is referenced in this many times, Robin Dies at Dawn. And in that story, Batman participated in an experiment for NASA that caused him to hallucinate that Robin was in constant danger. Morrison masturbated over this story and thus produced semen-like entries all over throughout his run of Batman, peppering the pages with semen that turned into Dr. Hurt. So, this is just an example of what he does. He takes an obscure, unimportant, never meant to be anything character from the early 60s. I'm not sure the writer or the it says here, Sheldon Moldoff was the writer who created this character. Sheldon Moldoff. I don't think Sheldon Moldoff ever expected unnamed scientist to become a character. But this hallucination thing, this experiment with NASA, becomes the basis for literally his entire Batman run to this point, Morrison's. Because we find out through the course of – and the doctor who works on him, the scientist, is Dr. Hurt. And Dr. Hurt is back all these years later revealing that he's had a master plan, of course, this entire time to undo Batman. And now he and his black glove, which is revealed to be a group of the only the richest of the rich, high rollers who gamble on people's lives, they've come back. And now Dr. Hurt's unveiling his master plan to undo Batman, humiliate him for the world, and all in the name of glorious crime. You follow me so far, Nick?
Sure.
So Dr. Simon Hurt is very ambiguous. We don't know his background. We don't know anything about him. He is the main villain of this piece. And he's kind of presented as a rather boring, rich, generic Batman villain in the beginning. He wants to undo Batman, and he uses a lot of cliches. He talks about the glory of crime. We're doing all this for crime's sake, to bring darkness into Gotham. And, of course, he talks about the Danse Macabre, which means, Nick, the Dance of Death.
Oh, boy.
You see, everybody has to get an invitation to show up to the Black Gloves. Danse Macabre. And wouldn't you know it, the Joker gives Batman his formal invitation to the Danse Macabre.
This is just the stupidest fucking thing. Like, it is trying so hard, Greg, to be intelligent. It is trying so hard to impress you with how brilliant, with how nuanced it is, that it comes across as the most self-important, pretentious piece of shit I've ever read in a comic book. Employment line.
Damn, Tony.
And that's a part, but if there's you think there's no like connection between Dan DiDio in charge of DC, you know, full control, and Grant Morrison reemerging in the last year? Like, you know what I mean? It's just one of those things. Like, he's in love with this kind of bullshit. Like, it's just both of them. Fuck them. I don't give a shit. Fuck them.
I mean, this Dr. Hurt, he's just not a nice fella. He has the Danse Macabre. He brings in Le Bossy, El Sombrero, which means the hat, Nick. I remember that from Spanish class from high school. And all these other characters that we are so familiar. For some reason, there's like 9 French characters, and I've never quite understood why there is both a Monsieur Le Bossy and a Pierrot Lunaire. I've not quite understood that. But there it is. Nonetheless, they're there. We don't get any of the other classic Batman villains in this story, Nick.
No, because if you're going to do a story about, you know, about the ultimate defeat of Batman, it would make no sense to use the deepest rogues gallery in all of comic history. Instead, let's create a bunch of new shitty villains that, I mean, that literally would pose no physical or mental threat to Batman whatsoever. It is never explained adequately in the pages of Grant Morrison's Batman run why fucking Le Bossy or El Sombrero or even Simon Hurt would be any kind of a threat to Batman. It makes no sense.
And here's the other aspect of this. So I'm going to touch on this before we get to the part later on. We'd circle back around to the fandom of this book. How many times in my life, if I had a nickel for every time in my life that this happened, I would be a rich man, that I have had to put up with online people shitting and pooping and shitting all over the death of Superman and Nightfall for a variety of reasons, but primarily this is the reason that it comes down to the most, that Doomsday and Bane are shitty, new invented villains, and that if anybody was going to take down Batman and Superman, it should have been Lex Luthor and the Joker that took down those two characters. By God, they loved them some Black Glove. It just goes to show that 90s bad, Morrison good, even if they're doing the exact same thing.
And even if one of them is comprehensible, where the other is a
because one is being written for a general audience, and the other is being written. Everybody wants to bitch and moan about how kids don't read comics anymore. Well, gee, I wonder if part of it is because grown adults can't keep up with what the fuck's going on. What do you think a kid would make of this? If there's like a 13-year-old that picks up his first Batman comic and it's like the first chapter of Batman RIP, he's going to think to himself, what is a Dr. Hurt? Who is a Jezebel Jett? And why is Batman making love to her right in front of Robin and Alfred?
And why is Alfred crying and masturbating?
And why is Robin not being invited to join in? Yeah, so that's another thing. Dr. Hurt is his own enigmatic figure. We'll get back to him. We are also introduced here to the love of Bruce Wayne's life.
Yes, the love of his life.
Not Selina Kyle.
No.
Not Vicky Vale. Vicky Vale. Not Silver St. Cloud. Not that one reporter lady from Batman the Animated Series, whose name I don't remember. Not Vesper Fairchild. No, the love of his life is Jezebel Jett. That's right. Oh, Jezebel Jett. Now, why, if you're Bruce Wayne, the smartest man in the world, do you not suspect that a woman whose name is Jezebel is indeed going to turn out to be a Jezebel? Nick?
Especially when, like, she is verbatim laying out the villainous Black Gloves viewpoint in the second issue where she is saying, wait a minute, Bruce, but what if all of this is just in your head? What if you're just crazy? What if you're just damaged? What if you're just messed up in the head? Which, what a unique angle to take on a Batman story. Maybe Batman is emotionally and mentally damaged from the events of his life. Huh. That's a new one.
Yes. And I thought when I was reading it, I was like, well, you know, that's kind of an, you know, I could see that being an interesting story if you tell the story that Batman has created his own villain for himself. Subconsciously, maybe there's something you can do there. It might be trippy, but could actually be a fun and intelligent, thought-provoking story. But of course, that's not where they go. But she introduces the concept. So, oh, but wait, Nick, I forgot. I shouldn't have even posed that question to you because he did know. He knew the entire time. He knew it from the moment that he started falling in love with her.
That she was clearly there just to fuck with him.
But he played along because of that. What, Nick? The acting lessons from Alfred.
Oh, God.
So, well, again, we'll circle back to that. The plot of this is Batman trying to find out about the Black Glove and the Black Glove enacting its ultimate plan to take down Batman. Dr. Hurt, apparently, with this experiment all those years ago, implanted a code word into Batman's psyche that, when enacted, would cause him to suffer a psychological split, a breakdown in his mind. And that code word, of course, Zur-En-Arr, which is a reference, because everything in this is a goddamn reference, to, of course, a story from the 50s or 60s, I've already lost interest in determining which, where Batman dressed up, a Batman of an alternate dimension dressed up in a multicolored rainbow costume. You've probably seen it online.
Batman 113, August of 1958.
Ah, yes. 1958. That classic year of Batman comics.
The character is the alien Tlano from the planet Zur-En-Arr.
Which works better and makes more sense than this bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's revealed that Dr. Hurt implanted this code word in Batman's DNA that when he sees or hears it will force a psychological break that will cripple him, essentially.
Described as a, quote, mental backup operating system, an entirely separate personality he has installed in his brain so that if his main personality ever fails, he can have a backup.
This is separate, though. This is separate. because that was Batman's preparation for the preparation. Mm-hmm. Remember? So Dr. Hurt didn't know that Batman would have that preparation for his planned subconscious assault.
Ah, yes, that's true.
So anyway, when he sees Zero and R, he locks up and he says, I can't be, what's going on? And see, Jezebel and those around him have already gotten him to start questioning his own sanity about investigating into the Black Glove, that maybe there is no Black Glove. Maybe he is the Black Glove. Then the Club of Villains infiltrates the Batcave. They beat Alfred mercilessly with a baseball bat and leave him virtually comatose. After sowing seeds of doubt in Bruce that maybe Alfred was betraying him, which he wasn't, the one good thing about that is I remember a frantic college-age Nick Duke bitching and moaning about the thought of Alfred turning on Bruce, saying that he would give up DC Comics forever if they did that. It was fun times. But nonetheless, they didn't do that. And anyway, Bruce is then tied down to a bed, and we're told this in non-linear fashion, of course, but I'm trying to make it linear. And he's injected with weapons-grade crystal meth and heroin.
And we don't say that it's weapons-grade. Dr. Hurt explicitly states this is weapons-grade crystal meth, whatever the fuck that means.
And he menacingly holds up two giant needles in the flashback sequence that reveals this. They inject Bruce with these drugs, these horrible weapons-grade drugs, and they toss him out on the streets like a bum. And he wakes up and he goes through withdrawal symptoms. He's sick. And he meets his new best friend, a homeless man by the name, Nick?
Honor Jackson.
A homeless man who speaks in cliches. And of course, Honor Jackson is depicted as a panhandling African-American gentleman, and is written in a very stereotypical and, you know, borderline offensive way. not good. Not good. What are your thoughts on Honor Jackson? Maybe you were a fan, Nick.
No. It just didn't serve any purpose. It was just an entire issue of, again, nonsense and psychobabble. And then at the end of the issue, it's revealed that, oh, I don't know what you're talking about, man. Honor Jackson died yesterday. And Bruce is like, but I just spent the entire day with him. And he actually gave Bruce the bat radio.
The bat radio.
Yes.
So Honor Jackson leads Bruce on what he calls an odyssey across town to try to hook him up with his buddy, what is it, One-Eyed Lincoln or something?
I don't know.
One-Eyed Lincoln or something like that.
One-Eyed Monster. Step right up to see the one-eyed monster.
That looks just like my husband's Willie.
Woody Harrelson.
So, Honor Jackson, who says things such as, you say that, but dope don't grow on trees, or maybe it does. What am I, a horticulture expert? That's $2 bags right there. I'm going to keep the other half. So you got a strung-out drug addict Bruce Wayne, which this comes from the same writer who gave us strung-out drug addict Magneto in New X-Men, so it shouldn't come as much of a surprise. Lone Eye Lincoln is the guy.
Sure.
I had to get you up and walking long enough to get your head clear. Come 11 o'clock tonight, walk 8 blocks in that direction and tell Lone Eye Lincoln that Honor Jackson sent you. Make your choice with a clear head is all I'm saying. You can fall or you can rise. The implication is given when he finally meets Lone Eye Lincoln that Honor Jackson had died 24 hours previous, so he didn't exist. But yet he had to have existed because he gave Batman the Bat Radio, right?
Yes, the Bat Radio apparently is another reference to this 1958 story, because the Batman, the actual Batman of Zur-En-Arr, possessed a bat radio with which he could jam atmospheric molecules affecting the equipment of his enemies. And after the two Batman parted ways, this Tlano, the Batman of Zur-En-Arr, left Bruce with the bat radio. And then I guess apparently Bruce hid it on the streets in case he ever got injected with weapons-grade crystal meth so that he could conveniently find it in the event of a psychotic break.
So, Bruce finally gets that sorted out, sort of, but then he starts hallucinating, or is he, that a small, impish version of himself is floating around on his shoulder, talking to him. This, of course, being Batmite. I don't know much about the history of Batmite, but I know he was around in the Silver Age. He was the Batman equivalent of Mr. Mixyes Spitalik. I think I got that right. A fifth dimensional imp who looked up to Batman and worshipped him as his hero. And anyway, Batman starts seeing him on his shoulder, talking to him. But not just Batmite. He also becomes the Batman of Zur-En-Arr and accepts it. He sews for himself a multicolored Batman suit, much like that old 50s story. Then the gargoyles in Gotham City start talking to him. He tells Batmite, am I nuts, or did these things just talk? And Batmite says, you're totally sane. But never mind the gargoyles. The bad guys are on to you. We can't stay here, Batman. And the gargoyles say, we've only been watching over the city for 80 years. What do we know about anything? Such a great story already. We're also revealed about all of these damn backstories about things that Bruce went through. Meanwhile, we still don't know anything about the Black Glove. We're learning a little bit. They let the Joker out to invite him to their Danse Macabre, which is their fancy name for luring Batman to Arkham Asylum so they can bury him alive. The Joker says a bunch of babbling nonsense that means nothing. And meanwhile, Dr. Hurt is either Thomas Wayne, who he claims to be, Mangrove Pierce, an actor who once played Thomas Wayne, apparently. The Devil.
God Almighty.
A servant of Darkseid. Or Darkseid himself. We don't know. We don't know. We can only try to read between the lines. Now, in fairness, the Darkseid stuff only comes out later, in a later part of the run. So we don't. That's not fair to really hold that on this, but we do have speculation that he's the literal devil. So that's enough, I think. Or Thomas Wayne, who the Black Glove puts out evidence that Thomas Wayne was a drug addict who had orgies on the weekends and actually organized the shooting that killed his wife, and it was supposed to kill his son, but Joe Chill lost his nerve. And so now Thomas is back all these years later to try to take out Bruce the way he should have when he was a child, or to have Bruce pledge himself to the Black Glove. But of course that's not true, or at least we don't think it's true. So all of that's going on, and we also get appearances in this book from the Batman supporting cast. Alfred, who of course gets beaten with a baseball bat. Tim Drake, who gets run around town by the members of the Club of Villains as they're trying to bring him in. And my personal favorite, Nick, Dick Grayson, Nightwing, who gets beaten up by who? I don't know. I don't even remember who beats him up. Beaten up by somebody. One of the members of the Club of Villains gets the jump on him, beats the hell out of him, renders him comatose, brings him to Arkham Asylum, where Monsieur Le Bossu, under his civilian, you see, Le Bossu is a respected doctor and surgeon who's like 4'10", I guess.
Sure.
And when he becomes Le Balsud, he puts on a disfigured mask and hunches himself over because, as we learn here, Nick, Le Balsud is French for the hunchback.
Mm.
Not just French for the Basu, as I once thought. So this hunchback figure is Le Balsud. But while he's also been hired on as a surgeon at or as a doctor at Arkham, and so he basically puts Dick Grayson in a straitjacket, sedates him, and is planning to perform a lobotomy on him. All as part of their plan to get Batman by striking at those that matter to him. Of course, because I've never seen that happen before or since in the world of Batman comics. Anyway, this doesn't work out. Dick Grayson breaks free at the last minute. It shows up to help Batman, but not enough, apparently. There's so much going on here, Nick. I don't even know where next to go with it. Dr. Hurt is full of shit. His plan doesn't work. He underestimates Batman. Oh, here's the other thing. You were talking about why these characters would pose any kind of a physical or mental threat to Batman. Here's the trick. They don't. They don't. Because, ultimately, this is Grant Morrison's way of writing Batman is the extreme version of the criticism that other writers have gotten that never seems to fall his way of the, quote, Bat God writing, where Batman is superior to everyone else around him because he's literally, literally prepared for everything. He's prepared for things that you could not possibly prepare for, but he's prepared for them. For instance, it's revealed at the end of this book, and you tell me if I'm misreading this, but this is how I read the page, that Batman knew that Jezebel Jett was with the Black Glove.
Yes.
Knew that, or at least thought, that Dr. Hurt was Mangrove Pierce, and knew that the Black Glove was an organization, even though he explicitly states earlier in this story that he doesn't know if it's a person or an organization. But he knew that it was an organization because he knew all the information about Jezebel's past and what the Black Glove killed her father and mother and left her in charge, killed her father, turned her mother into a psycho, and left her in charge of that country, and that she was then part of the Black Glove. So he knows all this information about the Black Glove, all of that stuff. He planned for this whole thing, and he had that backup human operating system, as you put it, Nick, earlier, actually as Grant puts it in the book.
For God's sake.
He referenced it, that just in case he ever suffered a psychological attack, because he suspected it even all those years ago that he was already under attack. So he has this backup operating system, the Zur-En-Arr, to bring him back to his senses.
What are we doing?
And get him back in the fight.
Well, I mean,
so ultimately, there was never any peril. Because Batman had prepared for every mother freaking thing that happens here.
What are we doing? Like, there's no point in trying to go through the entire plot of this because the plot is nonsensical. It is self-referential, masturbatory bullshit. Like, it's just... Fuck this. I don't know.
It's not a lie. It's just bullshit. Okay, there's another thing here that I want to talk about. Grant Morrison's obsession with holes. We've often laughed here on the show, Nick, about that immortal line from the Final Crisis Superman tie-in. I'll go fix the hole in forever. Right? Well, right here, we have, in a span of a few pages, Bruce Wayne, in a flashback, talking to this evil monk who is attempting to poison him, and he says, he's talking about these things that he found on his spiritual journey. He says, I found a hole in my mind waiting to open up and swallow me whole. Oh, but it's foreshadowing, Nick, because later in the book, Dr. Hurt says, I am the hole in things, Bruce.
Mm-hmm.
The enemy, the piece that can never fit there since the beginning.
But he wasn't.
No. And we never find out, by the way. In this story, we never find out who Dr. Hurt is, do we?
No.
We don't find out the truth.
It's just one part of a much larger epic tale that's being built.
That encompasses not just Batman, but Final Crisis as well.
Final Crisis. Batman Incorporated. Batman and Robin.
The Return of Bruce Wayne.
The Return of Bruce Wayne. My lord.
But anyway, we should probably just say, how does Batman die? It's Batman R.I.P. It's the death of Batman, right?
He doesn't.
Yeah, he doesn't. He doesn't. This book has no conclusion.
No, there's a helicopter crash that makes you think that Batman might have died, and then it jumps forward to 6 months later with a Batman that is not shown who the Batman is running around doing stuff, and that's mm-hmm. what you have.
Yep. But as we find out in the epilogue of this book, Batman is still alive. He's been tied into a dream machine.
By the minions of Darkseid, apparently.
But we don't know that they're the minions of Darkseid, because that's never mentioned here.
Well, the Wikipedia summary says they're the minions of Darkseid, Greg.
No, they are the minions of Darkseid.
And what finer tradition is there on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network than reading things off of Wikipedia?
Absolutely. But yeah, the beauty of that is, this is a tie-in to Final Crisis that does not mention Final Crisis.
Nope.
That does not mention Darkseid or Club Darkseid or whatever the hell. It's these two apocalyptic dudes that we don't know are apocalyptic dudes. They just look like two random guys we've never met. And some creature called the Lump that looks just like Clayface, does he not?
Yes, he does.
Who are sitting there wreaking havoc on Bruce Wayne's psyche through his dreams. But he figures out that things are wrong, the dream sequences are wrong. And again, I'm waiting for some sort of conclusion. Batman breaks out and beats these guys up. He doesn't. He breaks out, but we don't see what happens. You have to read Final Crisis to get that. There's no conclusion here. The Batman dies and there's no fallout of what happens from the – not die. He doesn't die. But the helicopter crash happens. There's no fallout from what happened. There's no emotional resonance. There's no reactions from anyone. There's just people looking at the wreckage, or the wreckage, if you will. It is incomprehensible. It is bad storytelling. It is incomplete storytelling. You know, we've often heard that thing that every comic is someone's... I shudder to think of anyone whose first comic book was anything in this entire collection. Because though it makes sense, there is nothing here that makes sense, in my opinion. Now, there are those that disagree with us, which we'll get to in just a moment. But Nick, give me your thoughts on the story. Because I know a few chapters into this story, you were saying, well, not as bad as I remember. Not good, but not as bad as I remember.
Wait. Two chapters, because the first two chapters, you know, outside of that god-awful Batman-Joker scene, are relatively straightforward. You got Batman running around doing things. You know, Tim is voicing concerns about being worried about him or whatever. And it's relatively straightforward stuff. And then at the end of the second issue, when the Zurin R hammer drops, and then it turns into just bullshit. I mean, just unintelligible, pseudo-intellectual horseshit. I don't even really know what else to say. There is nothing redeeming about this book to me. There is nothing that makes it worth revisiting. There is nothing that makes it worth recommendation. You know, there have been bad stories before that have outstanding art, but Tony Daniel is, to borrow an old Blog of Doom phrase, he is the Cody line of Batman artists to me. Like, he is where mediocre lives. And then you attach mediocre art to this incomprehensible, you know, pretentious bullshit of a story. I can't recommend this to anyone for any reason. Nor would I.
I like Tony Daniel. I like his art. Unfortunately, I think his figures here are really good. I like the way he draws Batman. I like the way he draws Joker. I like the way he draws all these people. But unfortunately, it's so dark and the storytelling is so muddied in terms of what's going on and who's where and who's fighting who that it does nothing to enhance the clarity of an already convoluted story. So while I respect him as an artist, this is not his best example of his work. And in addition to that, the story, the dialogue, everything is just so incomprehensible, pretentious, up its own ass that, again, I can't recommend it to my I would only recommend it to my worst enemy to read, to say, you know what, here's a good usage of your time. I want you to pore over this and give me a book report on it explaining what happened. It's just not good. But you know what, Nick? Maybe we're the problem.
Have you ever thought about that? No, obviously we are. We discussed that earlier. I mean, the only reason we don't like the story, Greg, is because we're just not smart enough to get it. Because our minds aren't open enough to really be accepting of Grant Morrison trying to do something different with the Batman mythos. And it's our small, closed minds that cause us to not like this story, Greg. We are not woken, as it were.
Listen, you know what the word is that shows how brilliant this is, and all you have to do is write it, and suddenly it'll become apparent to you that this story is brilliant. That word is deconstruction.
Oh, deconstruction, yep.
Because, you know, you can make any comic book sound great if you just use the word deconstruction when reviewing it. It's a deconstruction of the Superman mythos. It's a deconstruction of the X-Men concept. It's a deconstruction of Batman. So I think – so. I'm going to read some people – let's read to the folks out there some alternate perspectives on Batman RIP, Nick, just to balance the scales a little bit. I think it's only fair, right?
Sure. Go ahead.
This one comes to us from Thom Dunn, Thomdunn, of Tor.com, Science Fiction, Fantasy, the Universe, and Related Subjects, How Grant Morrison's 7-Year Batman Epic is Becoming the Ultimate Definition of Batman. This came to us – near the end of Batman RIP in 2012. He says, I'm going to skip a little bit here. He says, as with much of Morrison's work, his extended run on Batman was full of several recurring motifs. But perhaps the most interesting through line in this story has been the constant presence of bat analogs, wannabes and replacements, heroes who, by will or requirement, have attempted to become the Dark Knight themselves, and villains who have aspired to supplant him. Morrison uses this device to deconstruct the identity of the Dark Knight and explore precisely what it is that makes Bruce Wayne tick. What does he have that the other heroes don't? Why does this man of all people get to be the Batman? Really deep stuff here, Nick. Do you have one?
Oh, I can. I might have a couple. Let's see here.
We'll just trade them back and forth here.
Yeah, let's go over to... Hold on a moment. Make sure I got a good one. No, that's not quite good enough. Oh, here we go. Here's one from Sci-Fi Now. Grant Morrison's Batman is the best since Frank Miller. Here's just a sample of what Morrison has brought to the table with his run. He's killed the Dark Knight, reinvented the idea of Batman and Robin for a modern audience, portrayed Bruce Wayne as a caveman, reinvigorated forgotten parts of DC mythology, explored the idea of Batman being a global crime-fighting franchise, and even found a place for Batmite as a hallucination. The end result is an ambitious body of work that has taken risks at every step yet retained critical and commercial success throughout. This is an unprecedented, all-angles take on the DC icon that will be reflected on fondly in years to come. For me, the fundamental appeal of Morrison's epic comes down to the maturity of his take on Bruce Wayne. Morrison's Batman encompasses every era of the character that has come before. From the gritty Frank Miller tales that fans revere, to the campy dynamic duo stories that were prevalent in the 50s and 60s. In Morrison's depiction of Bruce Wayne, they all count as part of this character's colorful life, both good and bad, with each iteration representing a different part of Batman's biography. The figure Morrison conceived was a Batman at the very peak of his powers, bolstered by these many shades of of insane experiences.
That's powerful stuff, Nick. I've got one from my personal favorite online comic book critic, Chris Sims,
who is nothing if not a giant pretentious douchebag. Anyway, but here's his review of Batman R.I.P. or of in general. Somebody sends him a question to his Ask Chris column. Batman R.I.P., what exactly is going on in this book? I like Morrison, but I do not follow the plot. He says, my friend, you've come to the right place. I generally think Grant Morrison gets a bad rap for writing superhero stories that are too complex. But R.I.P. is a story with a whole lot of moving parts that can be pretty hard to keep track of, unless you're the kind of person who has been obsessing over the details of 75 years of Batman comics for their entire life. Fortunately for you, that's exactly what I am, and that's the reason why Batman R.I.P. is probably my favorite Batman story of all time. And really, it doesn't get that confusing until you start trying to figure out if the bad guy is just a man in a costume, the actual devil, Bruce Wayne's father, or a horrifying hyperadapter sent back in time by the God of Evil's Omega Sanction, which also possessed the Riddler into trying his hand at black magic. He says, oh, the first big point about Batman R.I.P. is that despite the title, Batman doesn't die in it. I remember this being a pretty big bone of contention among readers back in 2008 who had been sold on this being a big death of Batman story. On the one hand, that's understandable because DC certainly billed it as such. On the other hand, the very first page of Batman number 676 has Batman yelling, "You're wrong. Batman and Robin will never die." A word balloon that I'm like 90% sure I'll have tattooed on my body at some point. And Morrison is nothing if not a writer who plays fair with his audience. But wait, Nick, there's more.
Yes.
When I scroll down this, I'm trying to get to his overall point here. He has an overall summary here. Oh, he also mentions this about, I'm trying to find what he says about Jezebel Jett. Come on. Jezebel Jett. Ah, it's Jezebel Jett, who makes a perfect romantic foil because they have so much in common. She's a fabulously wealthy orphan, but rather than spending her money on rocket cars and utility belts, she's a philanthropist who uses her fortune for the benefit of her country. Not gonna lie, that part's particularly brilliant because it chips away at Batman's confidence by weaponizing the same criticism that people have about his character in the real world. And in conclusion, he says, when the one thing you have to remember, oh, this is a good way to explain the story to us. What you have to remember is that, quote, Thomas always lies. And so when Batman tells Thomas that he's actually Mangrove Pierce, an actor who was framed for murder years ago and joined up with the Black Glove, we have no reason at all not to believe him. At every point of this story, Batman has been one step ahead of everyone else. Awesome stuff here, Nick.
I don't have a name on this one, but here's a piece from What Culture? Pro Wrestling. Or not pro wrestling, excuse me. 9 reasons Grant Morrison's Batman R.I.P. is a masterpiece. The number 2 reason he lists on his countdown of 9 is negative fan reaction / the fulfilled premise. And he says, Batman R.I.P. is a challenging read. It's one of the reasons why it's such a great Batman book, because it has so many layers and interpretations, not to mention ingenious storytelling methods and an enormous amount of imaginative scenes and ideas all thrown in and mixed together by a genius writer at the top of his art form. But it's not a standalone book. You need to have read Batman and Son and The Black Glove before coming to R.I.P. to get the most out of it. If you read this as a standalone book, and it's not really meant to be read as such, then you're going to be confused. And I think some people who read it this way had their confusion manifest in anger. That said, I'm sure there were more than a few who had read the preceding 2 volumes before R.I.P. and still didn't like it, which is fine. But it is a demanding read, and Morrison's books have, more than many others, shown how comic books, particularly superhero comic books, can be as intellectual and as complex as any contemporary novel. To this end, the stories are unlike other Batman books and tend not to follow a linear plot or an obvious message. And this can bother some people who prefer to have their stories spelled out to them. They'd rather not engage with a story beyond what's written on the page, whereas Morrison is willfully asking the reader to meet him halfway with some of his books, Batman R.I.P. being one of them. It's also important to note that Batman R.I.P. is Morrison taking a Batman apart at the psychological level, which is reflected in the fractured and non-linear storytelling. You have to fill in some of the scenes in between the panels yourself. Maybe, bizarrely, some readers felt cheated because they expected Batman to die for real and only saw an ambiguous explosion followed by some issues that clearly showed him alive. Of course, there are some people who simply don't like Batman's or don't like Morrison's writing style, full stop. And that's why they don't like think much of R.I.P. or any of his books like The Invisibles or All-Star Superman. And that's fine, too, but they're wrong. Grant Morrison is amazing.
They're just wrong. We're just wrong, Nick. That's what it comes down to.
Oh, here we go, here we go. And the final reason why it's a masterpiece is entitled, number one, A Work of Art. Following the Batman Joker Dead Man's Hand prologue is a page where a young Bruce Wayne is shown screaming in the rain, and a massive quote announces, "What we are about to do will be a work of art." And that's exactly what they did. Morrison sets out to tell the most Batman story ever, and he does it with R.I.P. Morrison throws everything at Bruce in this book, and he's still going. Not only that, but shortly after the book ends, he goes up against Darkseid in Final Crisis. As much as I've talked about this book, I know I haven't explored every aspect. I've spoken to friends who have talked at length of their own interpretations, and its meaning that have differed from mine. You probably have your own interpretation of R.I.P. That's part of the brilliance of this book. It's also a Batman book for grown-ups. Sure, Batman started out as a comic for kids, but his readership has changed over time, and I would say his audience is largely made up of people over 18, so it's wonderful to have a writer like Morrison writing complex, engaging, and thought-provoking stories like Batman R.I.P. It is a work of art for all of the reasons above and more, and it's Batman, the best kind of art.
You ever encounter other comic book fans that make you not want to be a comic book fan?
Oh God, all the time.
Yeah. Well, that's what those people make me feel like, Nick. Listen, if there's people that like this story, to each their own. Everybody's got different opinions about everything, but the idea that the only reason that you don't like this story is because you're just not smart enough or grown up enough to get it. That's what pisses me off. It's deliberately self-referential. It's deliberately tied up in 80 years of bullshit that makes it impenetrable to the average reader. But because there's references to things, oh, it's cool. What a great thing. I understand that he's referencing a 1950s Batman story. It doesn't make it good. It doesn't make it make sense in context. Nick, this story sucked.
It did. It's absolutely terrible.
What are your thoughts on Batman R.I.P., listeners? Let us know by tweeting us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87, sending us an email to GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com, NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com, or by going to the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. We always like to have conversations there. In this case, we really don't, though, because this entire discussion impressed me. Reading this book made me see only the worst things in life and did nothing to alleviate my recent issue of being cold on comics. Nick's was bad. This was just bad.
Yes, and if you like it, please do not send us feedback. Do not try to convince us that it's good. We have no interest in having the discussion with you. Your taste in comics is probably very poor and different from what we enjoy, so let's just let you have your opinion. You sit over there, and you just leave us alone and don't really provide us with any feedback. And if you wanted to not listen into the show anymore, that would be fine too.
How do we know anyone's listening right now?
We don't. I'm just saying if they like Batman R.I.P., they probably shouldn't.
It could be a Funhouse mirror version of ourselves.
Mm.
As Chris Sims is trying to explain that perhaps Thomas or perhaps Dr. Hurt was a Funhouse mirror version of Batman's father who secretly hated his family and wanted them murdered.
Instead of a Dante Macabre, Greg, we should have a Dante Obese.
I think we should, which would be any Dante that we attend.
Yes, because
right?
We're obese, you see.
Yes. Anyway, this sucked. We're going to move on. When we come back, if we still have any energy left, we're going to hit you up with our usual stuff, reading and watching in the rundown, right after these messages.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place B Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceBNation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place B Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB in Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post-Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Ho Ho Loon Plaza is alive and well for the second half, and hopefully a cheerier half of our show. Greg Phillips here alongside Nick Duke, and we are here to bring you so much great content. Okay, none of it's great content, but we're here to bring you content nonetheless. And here to kick it off, we're going to give you our weekly look at the PN news and notes in the world of comics. It's a little segment we like to call the Rundown.
Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk about movies too.
Kicking it off this week is the retirement announcement of a true comic book legend, the fantastic artist, writer, creator extraordinaire, George Perez, officially announced his retirement from comic book work and private commissions on his Facebook page this week. He is known, of course, for lengthy runs on Justice League of America, New Teen Titans. He and Marv Wolfman really innovated and made what it is today. Wonder Woman, The Infinity Gauntlet, Avengers, Avengers versus JLA, everything in between, all characters under the sun. The greatest of all time at illustrating multiple characters on a page, at putting a splash page that can include literally hundreds of characters on it. No one's ever been better at those sort of big scale pages than George Perez. Of course, he's also the man responsible for the biggest event book in DC history, Crisis on Infinite Earths, that sort of created the modern era of DC Comics. But he says that due to health reasons, it's time for him to step away. He's not going to be able to do interior art anymore. He will be doing occasional sketches, drawings for different cons and things like that. But he's finished with his full-time comic book work. So always sad to see a legend walk away. But you know what? If you're going to go out, you want to see an artist get to go out on their own terms. And yes, it is health-related, and that sucks. But I'm glad that he's getting to see all of the impressions that he's left on fans over the years. Certainly one of the all-time greats.
Yeah, absolutely. You gave a laundry list of accomplishments. His legacy in the industry is much larger than any mere bibliography can do justice to, but a true legend, and like you said, good to see him go out on his own term. So big ups to Mr. George Perez.
Well, the company for which Mr. Perez did a lot of his work in his career, DC Comics, has announced some organizational changes this week. They laid off about 7 employees and rearranged things in an attempt to, quote, strengthen and evolve the division for future success. It says DC is going back to its roots of delivering epic stories with our world-class characters, stories, and brands, according to a memo they sent to their employees. Being a premier house of storytelling will never go out of style, and we intend to ultimately super serve our existing fans while providing new compelling content that engages and excites even more fans around the globe. End quote. As a result of this, SVP Sales Trade Marketing John Cunningham, who has been with the publisher for 13 years, Eddie Scannell, who has been Consumer Marketing VP and has worked for DC for over 3 years, lost their positions. The one that's really seeming to stick in the collective craw of a lot of creators at DC, though, is the loss of an art supervisor, of all things. He's a guy that's very well respected, and his name is Mark Chiarello, or Chiarello. People are very upset about this. He was a guy that's been kind of in charge of DC's covers for a long, long time, considered an excellent artist and an excellent person to work for. Going on, and he's been with DC, working with them since the Hellboy days of Mike Mignola, worked on Hush and other things along the way. He's been laid off. So big changes are going on, and speculation that our old friends at Bleeding Cool indicate that perhaps some editorial changes could be coming in the summer months. Nick, your thoughts on all this?
Obviously, it always sucks to see anybody lose their job. You know, I don't know much about Mark Chiarello. I don't know his reputation in the industry, but if creators are upset, there's probably a good reason for it. I did see a piece the other day that DC is publishing fewer comics now than it has in quite some time, just in terms of physical issues being brought to market or trade collections being brought to market. And you and I have made no secret of the fact that we'd like to see a change in editorial. You know, I love Jim Lee, but what do we really know about Jim Lee's tenure from an editorial standpoint? What great story ideas has Jim Lee brought to bear? We don't know. But the big one is it is high past time for Dan DiDio to be shown the door as the publisher or editor-in-chief or whatever his title is now of DC Comics. He no longer needs to be in charge of the creative direction. And while I know he just set up his own exterior, you know, studio to do contracted work, the short list for that job, if a change is made, should be one name long, and you know who it should be. So that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, I too am hoping for editorial changes to go on there at the company moving forward. Not necessarily. I don't want to see, you know, I love Jim Lee as well and all that, but like, and I'm sure there's a lot of folks that are fans of Dan DiDio,
But I just think that after all these years, a change could not be bad. Because what we've seen is we've seen a lot of unique initiatives over the years at DC, and ultimately they seem to get us back to the same place, which is not a position of familiarity and not a position of love. So in any event, let's move on to the next story here, which is that Target is kind of joining in on the 100-page giant game that that DC has also gotten into with Walmart. As you know, they produce these 100-page comics for Walmart that I actually haven't read any of these yet, Nick. I haven't even seen one of these. Have you?
Yeah, I've seen them, but I've not read them.
But they're you know, pretty popular, I guess, with Walmart. So now Target's getting in the game, and DC is putting out a book called DC. It's an anthology based on the DC Primal Age Funko toy line. This debuted Friday at participating Target stores on an end cap in the toy section, and includes stories by Marv Wolfman, Louise Simonson, Jerry Ordway, and more. That's pretty exciting, Nick. More. Anyway, good list of creators here. I gotta say, the concept doesn't really appeal to me that much.
Yeah,
but,
me neither.
But,
I saw some of the Primal Age toys at Target the other day. The designs, and it was, yeah, like you said, conceptually not really our thing, but at least Target is getting something out of the deal, and it's not being exclusive to Walmart. Although, if you compare the, you know, just the concepts and the titles that each is being given, I'm far more likely to read the Walmart stuff than I am.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I agree. I wish we could get some of those creators on the Walmart titles just to see. You know, I don't know. The idea of superheroes based in the dinosaur age has never really been my bag, maybe. Mm-hmm. But that's just me. You know what else is not my bag, Nick?
What's that?
Our first look at John Cryer as Lex Luthor on Smallville. Sorry.
No.
On Supergirl.
I don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear it. I have no interest in hearing it from you. Mister, oh, it's not going to be that bad. It might not
I never
be
said
that,
it wasn't going to be
it
that
might
bad.
Not be that bad.
It might not, and it might not have. It might not. It still might not. Maybe it'll be better than the image looks. But I will acknowledge that the opening image of John Cryer as Lex Luthor is every bit as ridiculous as I ever could have imagined it would be.
It's every bit as ridiculous as I said it would be.
First of all, he's got a beard. Which never, to my knowledge, well, there has been a bearded Lex. There was Lex Luthor 2, the red-headed Lex.
It doesn't matter if he has a beard or not. The point is, it's fucking John Cryer, and nobody's going to take it seriously.
And he's got a Hector Hammond-like bald head going on.
And he looks like a child molester.
Yeah, he does. He really does. He looks like he's been in prison for downloading things he shouldn't have been downloading. But nonetheless, it's happening. We're getting John Cryer as Lex Luthor, whether we like it or not.
And we don't, for the record.
No, we do not. Do not like. But one thing that I do like. One thing that I do like is Kelsey Grammer. TV's Kelsey Grammer. X-Men 3's Kelsey Grammer is coming to Arrow, our beloved Arrow.
Kind of.
Sort of.
Yeah.
In a way. Not on a full-time basis. What is he going to do there, you might ask? Oh, he's going to allow me to buy time, first of all. And second of all,
the gimmick of the 150th episode of Arrow, which is upcoming, is going to be an episode entitled The Emerald Archer. And the idea is that it's going to be a fake documentary. It will be a documentary about the history of the Hood and the rise of vigilantism in Star City.
Mm-hmm.
And that Kelsey Grammer, while he will not appear physically in the episode, will be narrating the fake documentary that is being produced for the episode.
I love this idea, Nick. This is really cool. I always like it when Arrow
goes outside the box for an episode or two mm-hmm. and does some kind of different things. I liked it on The Flash and they did the musical episode. And I think this is a great idea. It kind of reminds me of what they did with the Watchmen movie to do the under the hood mm-hmm. portion where they did it as like a documentary series about the Minutemen. That's kind of what it reminds me of. So I'm looking forward to this. I think this will be cool.
Yeah, it should be cool.
Now, do you think that this takes place in the future that we've seen on the show recently? Or do you think it takes place in current time?
Apparently it takes place in current time.
Okay. Very good. Thoughts on this, Nick?
No, I'm for it. Great documentary voice here for Kelsey Grammer. The only way it could have been better is if they had gotten like Morgan Freeman or James Earl Jones or somebody.
Morgan Freeman. James Earl Jones. Oh, that's Morgan. I was doing the Morgan Freeman voice to say James Earl Jones.
Yes, you did.
Anyway, also, there's another announcement that we're going to close things with this week. That is that Sandra Bullock, that's right, movie star Sandra Bullock is developing Mark Miller and Greg Capullo's Miller World Series Reborn into a film for Netflix. She will be producing it, and Lego Batman movie's Chris McKay is slotted to direct it. I don't know the first thing about Reborn, but this is pretty exciting for Misters Miller and Capullo, is it not?
Yeah, I don't know anything about Reborn either, but you know, this is part of that deal that we had talked about a while back on the show where Netflix had acquired Miller World and various properties therein, and they were going to begin to develop them for distribution. So when you consider that they've already paired up a pretty big-name A-list actress here, this is interesting. So good for all parties involved, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And with that being said, we wrap up this edition of The Rundown. Well, Nick, what's left? Of course, it has to be our long-running – oh, wait a minute. Is that a noise I hear in the background?
I don't know it. Is
could it be? Could it be the Hohaloon ticker?
Wait, what?
Is it? Oh, sorry. False alarm.
Oh. Oh, don't do that. That's not.
I'm sorry.
That's not fun. That's.
I'm sorry.
That's.
I thought it was going to produce us something, but it didn't.
That was manipulative, Greg.
Well, it manipulated me, but we keep it in here just for such occasions. But. In any event, we are here to bring you the segment that we do every single week here where we talk about what we've been reading and what we've been watching. It's the segment known to the world as, Nick?
Well, it's reading and watching, quite frankly.
Is reading and watching. What you been reading, Nick?
Batman RIP. Some other bullshit that I'm going to talk about on another podcast that I don't want to.
You don't want to spoil your thoughts on right now. Well, you are balancing the negative with the positive on that one, at least.
I am.
But that negative is a low negative.
I wouldn't say balancing, because as good as the one thing is, the other thing is much, much worse. How about that?
Yes. You can hear about that coming soon here on the pop feed in post-crisis management, actually. Letting the cat out of the bag there a little bit.
Oh, look at you telling tales out of school, as always.
What's the...
you told tales out of school last week. Spoiled your upcoming new podcast
That's
venture.
Right. Which has been recorded and should be uploaded by the time y'all are hearing this. So check out my new podcast, Talkin' WCW, alongside friends of the show, Tim Capel and Jennifer Smith.
There you are.
In any event, I also have not been reading anything other than Batman RIP, so got nothing there. But I have been watching stuff, Nick.
Yeah, some of our stories were back this week.
That's right. And... kicking things off on our schedule. We work things different from the actual CW schedule due to our usual
Yeah, we go Monday to Sunday. We cut it off at Sunday. So, like, for example,
right.
As we record this, Arrow is now back. Black Lightning is now back. We're not talking about those because our schedule is Monday to Sunday. So we're actually talking about the midseason return of The Flash and the midseason return of Supergirl because those were the only two to air last week.
Very good. So starting us off, we had an episode of The Flash.
Mm-hmm.
And in this episode of The Flash, Nick, if you had to describe what happened, how would you describe it?
Well, if I had to describe what happened, I would say that, first of all, it's really useful to not try to get ahead, and that way you get confused about what happened, and you rely on your co-host then to describe the events of episodes. Well, you had what happened here was you had Nora having to deal with the revelations about Thawne that she had learned from her father in the mid-season finale, and she goes back to the future and confronts Thawne with his knowledge. Thawne tells her that, you know, she's just going to have to trust him. For what end? We don't know. We really don't know what's going on here with Thawne and Nora yet. We don't know why they're aligned. We also get to see how this new knowledge is affecting her. She starts to take a harder stance against villains, including the new Weather Witch, who seemingly is attempting to turn over a new leaf and show remorse for her actions, but Nora is so disillusioned by her trust being violated by Thawne that she doesn't believe that any villain can truly turn over a new leaf, that all of them are just doomed to be evil forever and ever, and so she takes a very hard stance against that. Meanwhile, Barry's powers are out of control, so he has to hide in the power-dampening pipeline there for a couple of days to keep, until things can calm down a little bit. So you got all that going on. I'm trying to remember what other subplots. Oh, Cisco doesn't want to be Vibe anymore. He's decided he's going to search for a metahuman cure. And at first, Caitlin is like, no, don't do that. And then by the end of the episode, she's like, okay, let's do that. And that's what they're going to do the rest of the season, apparently. Sherlock is hot on the trail. He knows that something is not right with Nora. And he is working hard to uncover the truth.
Yeah, no shit, Sherlock. Mm-hmm. See what I did there? Hey, isn't it interesting that on two simultaneous shows, on The Flash, you've got a team that is working to develop a metahuman cure, and on Supergirl, you've got a team that is working to develop a metahuman drug that will create metahumans?
Yes, because if normal people have powers, they won't hate aliens anymore, Greg.
We'll get to that.
one of the worst pieces of character logic that's ever been stated on a CW show, which covers a lot of ground, by the way.
So, I thought Flash was really good, actually.
It was good.
A really good start.
You know why it was good, Greg?
Thawne,
and there ain't no Cicada or Chris Klein anywhere to be found.
Nope. He was absent from the episode, and I would argue that the episode was served by that.
I would agree.
It was great in that regard. I thought pretty much everything worked. The one thing that I will say is, how old is Nora supposed to be?
I do not know. I am going to guess like 20 at the oldest.
Because she acts like a child, yes. Like a literal child in terms of her steadfast, one-sided belief in everything until it changes wildly to the other side.
I think what I'm getting out of this is that after the death of her father in her timeline, she was probably sheltered somewhat by Iris. They kind of imply that, you know, with the whole like power dampening thing. And so I'm thinking that while she's not necessarily a child, she has not had the wealth of life experiences that a normal human being would have. So I think the childlike depiction of her at times is intentional on their part, in my view. But perhaps I'm giving them more credit than they deserve.
Hopefully. But it was a good show nonetheless.
Yes, it was.
Enjoyed it. Good start to the season. Thawne is awesome.
Yes.
And adds so much to the show.
Agreed.
Supergirl, which is kicking off the second half of the season for that show, kind of picks up the pieces of where we left off last season, which, by the way, actually, I watched a bunch of Supergirl this past week. Mm-hmm. I was four episodes behind. So I have caught up on Supergirl completely. And briefly my thoughts on the entire story arc right now, where Supergirl has been kicked out of the DEO because she refuses to reveal her identity. James Olsen went undercover in the Sons of Liberty, not undercover, but tried to get an interview with the Sons of Liberty, and it went badly. Supergirl nearly got killed, but he did manage to change one person's mind in there. Lena is trying to now develop this drug that will give humans meta powers. All of this is going on at the same time. And I got to say, you know, I was very critical of Supergirl earlier this year, Nick, if you remember on the show. I did not like the beginning of this season. I thought it was pretty bad, honestly. I thought it was very heavy-handed. I had no faith in them at that point. I lost faith in them to handle anything with subtlety or nuance. I have really enjoyed this last stretch of episodes. The last 4 to 5 episodes of Supergirl have been very, very good. And particularly as they got closer to the season finale, not counting the old stuff. And then this episode I thought was really, really good. The exploring the fallout of what happens when Supergirl is no longer with the DEO. They uncover more information about this complete bitch, Colonel Haley, that has taken over charge of the DEO, basically. And it ends, the episode ends in a very emotional scene that I was not prepared for, where Alex gets her mind wiped by Jean because they have to wipe out everyone at the DEO's knowledge of Supergirl's identity because Haley is going to find it out. I thought this was a really good episode, Nick. I loved it. I really did.
Yeah, I thought it was really good as well. A strong return from Supergirl. So both shows that came back from the mid-season break came back in strong fashion, and I'm sure that will only continue with the other shows that we'll talk about next week.
Yes, and yeah, so I guess, do we want to rank them, or is it too few shows to
talk about? Well, I mean, we can rank them. I'd go Flash and then Supergirl.
I would probably go the same. I don't know. It was close. I don't know. Yeah, I'll do that. But it was real close for me. So, anything else that I've watched this week? Let me think. No. Nothing. Well, whoa. My goodness. The digital clock on the wall tells me we've got a minute, Nick. It's time for the wrestling minute. Gosh, what's going on in the world of wrestling right now?
Lots of rumors swirling about current Raw Women's Champion Ronda Rousey and her contract status with the WWE post-WrestleMania. Some reports would have you believe that her contract will be up after WrestleMania. Some would have you believe that her contract is for a few more years, but she will be taking a hiatus from WWE in order to start a family after WrestleMania. Don't really know what to believe there, but certainly injects some intrigue into not just the women's division, but the entire idea of what might close Mania at this point. So we're not yet to the Rumble, but Mania speculation already running wild in the online community.
Absolutely. And meanwhile, the weekly shows, I thought Raw was not very good. It was fine. It wasn't good, but it was not as bad as it's been. But I thought SmackDown was... Oh, go ahead, Nick.
No, I was not, nothing. I was yawning.
I thought SmackDown was excellent, including what has turned into an early contender for Feud of the Year with just two matches down, Rey Mysterio versus the recently renamed Andrade.
Andrade, yes.
No middle or last name needed.
None needed.
They have been – I know you haven't been watching SmackDown, Nick, but they have been absolutely tearing it up every week with match of the year potential type candidates, as vouched for by one harsh critic himself, Mr. Chad Campbell. So,
match of the year. That means it probably got 3.5 stars.
these are top level matches going on between Andrade and Rey, and I for one, am hoping they get a chance to do it at the grandest stage of them all.
That's a lot of them wrestling on TV every single week to stretch it all the way to Mania.
I think they can do an interim feud with Rey and Joe, and then come back to Andrade at Mania if they chose to. They probably won't choose to do that, but
I don't know. We'll see.
Let's see. Anyway, that's been the Wrestling Minute.
Well,
So, with all that being said, next week, folks, we are going to be joined in the studio by my co-host on Talkin' WCW.
No, we will not.
Nope, it's going to be 2 weeks from now that that's going to happen.
Yes.
Jennifer Smith will join us in 2 weeks to discuss Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Uh-huh.
Next week, we're going to give you a mystery show. That's right. It might be a countdown. It might be an off the page. Those are the only two things that it might be. But it'll either be a countdown or an off the page, and we're going to bring it to you right here on our Traveling Fanboys, Nick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is where we are. And as we come to the end of this this episode, we're going to end as we do each week. And this week we have a very special musical exit. As, you know, Greg, let it never be said that we are nothing if not reactive to fan feedback. And, of course, we had our wonderful listener, Mike, on Twitter, at FrankFran29, who requested. He said, if I may be so bold, may I ask, and the only thing I'm gonna correct you on here, Mike, is use the proper nomenclature. When you refer to JR, remember, it is WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. May I request that JR sing Color Me Bad's I Wanna Sex You Up? It's not the performance we need, but TBF, it's probably the performance we deserve. So
TBF the Superstation.
Well, with all that being said, Mr. Ross, what can we do to accommodate our good friend Mike's request?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Nick. You know, I've been coming here for a few weeks now, and I thought about going home, I'll be honest with you. But usually when a talent wants to take his ball and go home, there's one of the two C's, right?
Right.
It's either cash or creative.
Cash or creative. That's exactly.
And I gotta be honest with you. When I saw the creative for this week, I wasn't so sure about this.
Mm-hmm.
I could make the argument that before what I'm about to do for you right now, I may not have ever even heard of a Color Me Bad. Nor have I heard of a I Want to Sex You Up. But nonetheless, for my listeners, for my fans, I've decided to come through once again right here on the Hard Travel Fanboys. I hit him. Come inside. Take off your coat. I'll make you feel right at home. Now let's pour a glass of wine, because now we're all up. I've been waiting for you, girl. Just let me hold you close to me. Why? Because I've been dying for you, girl, to make love to me. Girl, you make me feel real good. We can do it till we both wake up. Girl, you know I'm hooked on you, and this is what I'll do. I want to sex you all night long. You make me feel good, quite frankly. I want to rub you down. I want to sex you up, quite frankly. Let me take off all of your clothes, including your boots, because this is going to be a bunkhouse boogie. Disconnect the phone so nobody knows. Let me light a candle. Let me see if we can make it better. Making love until we drown in the sweat falling off of my fat, which always looks better brown than white. Girl, you know it feels real good. We can do it till we both wake up. Girl, you know I'm hooked on you, and this is what I'll do. That's me, good old JR, want to sex you up. Making love until we drown, I want to sex you up. All that I want to do is sex, that's right, sex you up. All night. Girl, you make me feel good. I want to rub you down. I want to sex you up, my sweet lover. All night long, I want to sex you up. Feel so right, it can't be wrong. Don't be shy, girl. Rescue me. I have one, folks, what I'm getting to right here, and maybe you're not following the gist of what I'm saying in this song, is this is what it comes down to. Cliff Notes version, right? I want to sex you up. That's what I'm getting to. That's at the heart of all it. Let's be honest. We can beat around the bush all we want. It comes down to the fact that I want to sex you up. That means have relations, fornicate one another. Open up your heart, and I'll set you free.
Hard traveling fanboys.